Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Hey everyone, this is Carrie Champion, the host of Naked Sports.
The all-new 2025 Nissan Armada Pro4X provides freedom. Freedom to explore, to go wherever you want, with your whole crew and all your toys. With a twin-turbo V6 engine, 8,500 pounds of towing capacity, and seating for eight, this unshakable fortress of a vehicle is built to take you on your next adventure. Drive the all-new 2025 Nissan Armada today. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Intelligent four-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
Anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Last week, we broke down the testimony of lead investigator Dan McGinnis. Through his testimony, we learned a little bit more about the crime scene, the positioning of Mario's body, and the lighting situation. But we also heard a lot of testimony about Jody's police interview on November 16th. McGinnis painted a grim picture of Jody. And without a recording of the interview, the jury was left to make a determination on Jody's guilt based solely on McGinnis' version of the story. We heard about Jody changing their story regarding certain elements, like whether or not they had any personal issues with Mario. And we also heard that, according to McGinnis, Jody said in the interview that they got off work 2 hours before the time reflected on the timesheet. McGinnis says that Jody told him that they got off work at 10 p.m. and arrived home at 11:02 p.m. exactly. And of course, we know that the timesheet that the jury never saw shows Jody clocking out of work at Dilo's at 12:05 a.m. Most of you listening have been around long enough to know that the last thing any defense attorney ever wants to do is to put their client on the stand. But after McGinnis' testimony, Jody really had no other choice. The only way for them to get their version of the story on the record and out to the jury was to testify in their own defense. And that's exactly what Jody did, and that's what we're going to cover in today's episode. The first 14 pages of Jody's testimony relate to their movements on November 13th, the day of the robbery. All the testimony about the robbery is super odd and kind of weird to even be reading. So you have Officer Sturgill, who I think we've proven is lying on the stand about identifying Jody at the scene. I really think that we proved that beyond any measurable doubt a few episodes ago. But we also have Jody lying on the stand about not being there. Jody was there during the robbery, but Sturgill didn't know that and fabricated a story to put them there, and Jody, who again was there, testified that they weren't there. I think the robbery discussion is basically moot at this point since Jody has now fully admitted to their part in it. But for the sake of creating a full and accurate record, I'm still going to be breaking down what was said about it at trial. On the stand, Jody said that their day on the 13th began at 11 a.m. when they had to meet with their probation officer. After leaving that meeting, Jody went home and Leon called them. Leon wanted to be picked up so that he and Jody could ride around and hang out while also putting in some job applications for Leon. Now, in McGinnis' report and testimony, he says that Jody told him that they never saw Leon on the day of the robbery. But here, Jody says they did pick Leon up, and on the way to get him, Jody made a stop to see if they could find some place for Leon to work. Quote, "We was going to ride around, you know, put in some job applications, you know, just basically kick it. But on the way, we'll put in some job applications. So I went to Damas on the corner of Thrasher and Bus. It's a Muslim like church called Damas on the corner of Thrasher and Bus. And I told like the preacher there that I had a little young guy that was looking for a job. You know, he doesn't have no place to stay. He basically lives on the street and all this. I'm trying to get him a job again the second time because he messed up the first job I got him. And so then he gave me a little card to give to Leon Newcomb to have him call him because he was painting his house and he told me he would use him to paint the house. So then I went to Leon Newcomb's house. On the way to Leon Newcomb's, I had just recently got some brakes fixed. He fixed my back's brakes, right? But now my front brake's going out. So on the way to Leon Newcomb's house, I'm noticing the car is sounding loud. End quote. Now, according to what Jody's told me, this part isn't true. They did have brake issues and they did get them fixed, but that fix had been done either the day before this or 2 days before this. At least the way Jody remembers it now. But in the testimony, Jody says that they dropped the car off at a guy named Melvin's house on the corner of Columbus and Empire. Then Jody and Leon walked up to the H&B party store. Now just to compare that to McGinnis' testimony, remember McGinnis said that Jody told them that they walked to the store with another guy, not named. So that part of the story is consistent, but Jody says they were there with Leon, and according to McGinnis, Jody told them they never saw Leon and they were there with some other different guy. And here, Jody says that they walked past Glenda Miles' house on the way to the store, where a woman named Shauna Henry and Carvale Miles' sister, who Jody refers to by her nickname Fatty Miles, I have no idea which sister this is, were hanging out. Jody says that Shauna asked them for 50 cents, and Jody said they would bring them some money after they go to the store. On the way back from the store, Jody says that they stopped back by Glenda's house to give Shauna some money. And this is when Jody says that they saw and spoke with Carvale. It's also one of several examples of Jody blurting out evidence that they feel points to Carvale as the killer. From the transcript, quote, "Then we came back and I gave Shauna a dollar, and we sat up there and talked to her because Leon used to actually go with Fatty Miles for a long time. As a matter of fact," White interjects, "who is Fatty Miles?" "That's Carvale Miles' sister, one of his older sisters." "So Leon Newcomb used to go with one of Carvale's sisters?" "Yeah, he actually shot a dude at their house. That's what he went to prison for." "Okay, so after you go to the store, you come back. Did you see Carvale then?" "Yeah, that's when we seen Carvale. As we were sitting on the porch, Willie Bledsoe, the dude that's Carvale's cousin, the one who knows about the 45 in Kalamazoo," end quote. Now, what Jody's referencing here is that Jody says that Shauna Henry had told them that the day after the murder, she gave Carvale a ride to the bus stop to flee town and go to Kalamazoo. We heard in Carvale's testimony a few weeks ago that he did in fact go to Kalamazoo for several weeks after the murder. He, of course, doesn't characterize it as fleeing or hiding, but he does confirm what Jody says they were told by Shauna Henry that he did in fact leave town. Willie Bledsoe, the guy that Jody mentioned in their testimony, is another person that told Jody about Carvale leaving town. And according to Jody, also told them that Carvale went up there to hide a 45 caliber pistol. Moving on through the testimony, Jody says that they hung out at Carvale's for 30 or 45 minutes. During that time, Leon went across the street to visit his girlfriend. Quote, "How long were you there at Carvale's house at this time?" "I have to say at Carvale's house at least half hour, 45 minutes, because actually I was waiting on my car to get done," end quote. So Jody acknowledges that they were at Carvale's that night, the night of the robbery, hanging out, just like Carvale and Glenda said, but the details of that interaction vary wildly. Jody says that they didn't ask about doing a robbery together and didn't show anyone any guns. And trying to piece together what really happened that night, at least in regards to the interaction at Glenda's house, I'm not sure what to really believe. So Glenda and Carvale tell this version where Jody and Leon are there for the purpose of recruiting Carvale to do the robbery. Remember, they said they stopped by to ask him if he wanted to hit a lick. Now, the utility here for the state in that testimony is that they solidify Jody's involvement in the robbery and connect Jody to the gold guns. But if you remember from the episode where we covered their testimony about this, there were some contradictions in their stories. Remember the discussion about Leon showing off the gold shotgun in the bathroom? They couldn't get their story straight, not where they were standing, not where they saw the guns, nothing. Now, I wouldn't think all too much about those discrepancies, But after we learned how much Glenda and Carvale changed their stories about the Shadis Wells threat and about hanging out with Mario on the night he was killed, I have my doubts about their story here. And not just because it conflicts with what Jody said or because their stories don't line up, more so because the whole story doesn't make any damn sense. Now don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that Jody wasn't there. I'm not saying that Jody didn't hold the gun to Mario and fight him over it. I'm saying that I don't think that Jody and Leon planned the robbery and went to Carvale's house to recruit him. Think about it. The alleged plan was to rob one guy. That does not take two people, much less three, when one of them has a gun. In Jody's version, Leon set off on his own to rob Mario, and Jody claims that they got involved when they saw that Mario had turned the tables and had a gun pointed at Leon. Jody claims that their involvement was simply them trying to stop their brother from getting shot. I know some people believe that and some don't, and that's fine, but it certainly makes more sense to me than two people with guns planning to rob a specific person when they have no way of knowing that that person would be at that location to begin with. And the plan was for one person to get in the car with the victim and hold him at gunpoint, and then a few minutes later have the second person come in with a second gun? That just doesn't square with me. But then we're also supposed to add to that story that beforehand, they tried to recruit yet a third person to help them rob Mario. I mean, at that point, this robbery would be more closely resembling a SWAT raid. I don't buy it. I'm not trying to tell you that you have to believe that Jody's version is absolutely true. I have no way of knowing that. All I'm saying is that Jody's version of the story makes a hell of a lot more sense to me than Glenda and Carvale's version. And for what it's worth, I know that there are some people out there that don't necessarily care if Jody killed Mario at this point because they think Jody is a violent criminal because of this incident in the robbery. But I'll tell you this, the evidence does seem to support that Jody was working hard to get their life together. They had issues with the law in the past, they had just gotten off probation. And if you look at the record, Jody was applying for a bunch of jobs, they were working at two different jobs at this time, they were making all their meetings with their probation officer. Jody says that they were trying to get their life together and trying to stay out of trouble. And the record does seem to reflect that. Even to the point where Jody was joining this Masonic lodge and had two cops, including McGinnis, as their mentors to get into the lodge. Now that's all anecdotal, and I know everyone's still going to believe whatever they want to believe, and that's okay. I just want to point out that when Jody told me the story about their reason being involved in the robbery at all was simply to protect Leon, I can't just write that story off. It does seem to track with the rest of the evidence that we have in the record. As the testimony about the robbery continues, there's nothing really to analyze. Jody testifies that they had no part in the robbery and says they were at home at the time. They also try to claim that Carvale was robbing Mario with Leon. So to be fair, it wasn't just Carvale making up stories about Jody. Jody did the same thing to Carvale here. Not quite as directly, but Jody says that from what they heard, it was Leon and Carvale. And of course, we know none of that's true. They might have heard that rumor, but Jody knew, and we know for sure, that Leon was in the car with a shotgun trying to rob Mario, and we know for sure that Jody came in later with the .22. Like I said, what Jody's motivations were in doing that are still up for debate. But as far as the rest of the testimony about the robbery, it's all about Jody trying to create an alibi for the time of the robbery, which doesn't really matter because we know it's not true, because Jody was there. Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.
As Jody's testimony continues, it's a lot of stuff that we've already covered, namely the kites and the letters they wrote. As you know, at trial, Jody does own up to writing the letters and kites, but they also used the opportunity to speak in front of the jury to try to get in testimony discrediting other witnesses and spewing out rumors that they heard while they were in jail. For example, Terrence Hunter. Remember, he was kind of the glue that corroborated some of the state's other witnesses. He said that Jody told him that they were concerned about a woman who had seen them at the scene that night, which corroborates Sonia Lucas's testimony. Terrence also testified that Jody had told him that they were stalking Carvale that night, which corroborated some of Canvas Smith's testimony. So while Jody's on the stand, they try to discredit Terrence. From the transcript, quote, "If I understand what you're saying, if I can cut through some of this, the reason you were writing these letters was to get the police to investigate." "Yes, I was in Greens. The police don't believe nothing you say when you're in Greens. Same thing Terrence Hunter did with me. Even though I would not have gone to the extent of setting a person up to get the police to listen, but it's the same thing he did. And I can kind of understand why he did it," end quote. This next bit I've read to you before, but it's worth hearing again after hearing what Shamika Jones saw that night. Remember, she said there was a group of 5 to 6 people outside by the car with Mario. From the transcript, quote, "Well, yeah, one letter that is addressed to the police and it says Telly Morris. Now, anybody with common sense, except for the police, would know that Telly Morris is actually saying telling more. I'm telling more, okay? That letter has Carvale, and it states Carvale Miles is having a shotgun. It says Terry Atkins or Archer, I couldn't figure out his last name, but Shattis Wells, who was in the dorm with me, and we can get his slip to let you know, Shattis Wells just got off the stand. He knows who killed Mario Lowe's that night, along with Dirty Bird, Big Pete, Jimmy Tillman. It was a lot of people over at that house that night. And if you pay real close attention to the telephone call of Vicky Miles, she tells you when she was looking out the window, she seen a lot of people, though she couldn't describe what they had on. It's because if you look on there, you can see that it was actually plastic over her windows. And when Dora set the fire to get rid of all the evidence, the plastic melted and you can still see it hanging in that picture that the prosecutor has," end quote. Jody says that they were hearing from all of these people that there was a big group of people on the scene that night. They say that this list of guys all knew who killed Mario. And we've discussed this before, but I have to believe that what Jody is saying here about Victoria's 911 call is true. If it wasn't, the state would have objected immediately for facts not in evidence. The jury had heard the call. It's not like Jody could just make that up. And Jody says that Victoria said on the 911 call that there were a bunch of people on the scene, but she couldn't describe their clothing. Jody is trying really hard here to do the job that their lawyer doesn't seem up to doing. Jody continues on, getting their version of the story into the record. They said that they wrote the letter from LeVar Jones because they had heard in jail that someone saw LeVar's car at the scene that night. Then Jody spends a fair amount of time talking about the letters written back and forth between them and Leon. Jody points out that in those letters, where Jody is asking Leon not to testify against them, that Jody never asks Leon to lie for them. Jody quotes from the letters where they suggest that if Leon just tells the truth, everything will be okay. They also make reference to a plea deal that Jody seems to have caught wind of, where the state was offering Leon boot camp for 90 days instead of prison if he would testify against Jody at the murder trial. And we also learn here that apparently, Leon was only 18 years old. I don't know why it never occurred to me to check, but Leon was just a kid. Check out this exchange as the prosecutor was cross-examining Jody. Quote, "When you offer an 18-year-old natural life as opposed to 90 days to turn on somebody else, do you think an 18-year-old is going to take that 90 days and turn on somebody else, especially somebody that he really doesn't know really all that intimately? Mr. Hill, you don't know what any agreement was with Leon Newcomb." "Oh, yes, I do. You didn't talk to me and you didn't talk to him, so you don't have any basis about what any discussions were with Leon Newcomb." "I talked to Terrence Hunter." "Well, you don't know where Terrence Hunter got that." "Where else did he get the rest of the information he has? Police reports, transcripts. He went to talk to the detectives with Leon Newcomb." End quote. Jody then goes on to talk about Terrence Hunter. How the testimony of Hunter was a word-for-word recitation of what McGinnis had written in his police reports. Jody says that Terrence was playing both sides of the fence, giving Jody information and at the same time making deals with the cops. Jody clearly did their research before trial, a lot more than their lawyer apparently did. Repeatedly, Jody is quoting from the police file during their testimony, especially the elements that point to Carvale being involved in the murder. Here, Jody explains when they first heard about Carvale being involved. Quote, "After I'd been locked up for about 4 months and Shauna Henry, the lady that took him to the bus stop, contacted Sherelle Moore and told Sherelle Moore that he would come and talk to my attorney, which was Paul Janja at the time, and then she told me about living with Carvale and all this, that's when I started to point the finger at Carvale and make the connection for why his, in his family, saying that I robbed him. They weren't saying that I killed him at the time." End quote. Then Jody points out that Canvas Smith picked Carvale out of a lineup. Quote, "She didn't know me. She couldn't pick me out of a lineup. She picked Carvale out of the lineup." End quote. And when the prosecutor gets into Victoria Miles' testimony, Jody is hammering away like a seasoned defense attorney. Quote, "Cotter, skinny and a ponytail. Jody, listen to the words. Tall, skinny. Oh, that's just a coincidence, right? Tall, skinny with a ponytail from a second-story building at 11:45 at night with plastic over the windows. And there's not, I mean, look at the pictures. There's not even a house with a motion detector on that side of the house." Cotter, "You just happen to be Jody. That's a big field." Cotter, "Tall, thin, with a ponytail, right?" Jody, listen to the phone call. She didn't say nothing about that." Cotter, "And it's just a coincidence that she identified out of three cars that were driven by her car, the lights that match similar to your car, that's just a coincidence too?" Jody, "If she know me as long as she's known me and know that car as long as she's known it, why didn't she know that car the night of the murder? And why didn't she never say nothing about a pushed-in bumper with broken taillights?" Cotter, "And it's just a coincidence that the car..." Jody, "That's not a coincidence." End quote. Then Cotter tries to tie Dewan James' testimony to Jody. Quote, "Dewan James said the car that fled..." Jody, "Listen to it." Cotter, "Just like yours, sounded like there was a problem with it. That's just a coincidence too? He said it sounds like a small car, actually." Cotter, "Or an engine that had a bigger engine that had problems when you were peeling out." Jody, "He didn't say bigger engine." Cotter, "Down that alleyway." Jody, "He said that it sounded like a small car. When a car peels out, all the cars sound the same." End quote. Cotter continues on with trying to make Jody look like a conspiracy theorist in front of the jury. He keeps going through the evidence and asking Jody sarcastically if that's just a coincidence. And Jody continues to fire right back. Quote, Cotter, "Mario said your name and told Sonia Lucas who killed him. that's just a coincidence? Jody, could we bring in her stepfather who claimed she was standing right by, and also Tommy Travis who tried to get Crime Stoppers by saying that he actually seen me while over at Sonia Lucas' house when she says she doesn't even know? Cotter, so that's either a coincidence or some other JoJo. Or she's in on this frame-up too, is that right? Jody, that's either she was paid because she doesn't want you to find out that Mario Lowe's was over at her house because it was a crack house, and that she's getting paid to let them sell dope out of that house, or even that she's tired of being harassed, like she said in the prelim by Detective McGinnis. End quote. Here, Jody was mentioning Sonia's testimony at a preliminary hearing. Now, I have the transcripts from that hearing, but the pages where all of the questioning about how she came to change her story are missing. But according to Jody, in that hearing, she straight up said that she was being harassed by McGinnis, which is the same thing that she told me. In general, this is one of the most interesting transcripts I've ever read. The testimony was wild. It was complete pandemonium. Jody is arguing with the prosecutor. They're narrating from the stand, neither of which are typically allowed in open court. And we see no objections. It reads more like a debate than a trial testimony. Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
In the final segment today, we're going to break down Jody's version, in their own words, of what happened on the night Mario was killed. During direct examination, things are pretty calm. It's pretty much just Jody sharing the story that you've heard before about their night. Jody says they went to work at Dialo's Cafe on the day of the murder at 10 a.m. They worked until about 5 o'clock when they had to attend an anger management class as part of their probation. Then at around 7 p.m., Sherelle dropped Jody back off at the restaurant. Jody says they worked late that night doing dishes, and while they were there working, Sherelle kept calling over and over again. Quote, "The whole time that I was in the restaurant washing dishes before I actually punched out, Sherelle kept on calling and kept on calling. When do you want me to pick you up? When do you want me to pick you up? I guess she wanted to pick me up at the same time she'd go to pick up Nadia, but I don't always want her to come pick me up, you know what I'm saying? So I told her Cornelius would drop me off at home. Don't call me no more. So when we went out behind the restaurant, and me and Sean and Cornelius was kicking it, I guess the phone was still ringing. So by the time I got home, she's sitting on the bed Indian style and arguing. Where was you? And I know you wasn't even at the restaurant." End quote. We also hear about Princella coming into the restaurant because she was mad about the lights being left on. Quote, "Now you've heard Princella Tobias testify that she came in at 11. She did. Okay, she cussed me out." End quote. White asked Jody how long they were still at the restaurant after Princella left, and Jody says that, quote, "Sean punched me out at 12 o'clock. End quote. Things were going pretty smoothly during direct examination. But during cross, Cotter was pushing back against Jody's testimony and how it compared to McGinnis's. This next bit is kind of a long exchange, and the conversation mixes between the night of the robbery and the night of the murder. You're going to hear Jody mention the woman who just got off the stand. That was Princella. You're also going to hear the one and only mention of the time card, and Cotter quickly passes by it. Remember, Jody had obtained a copy of the case file while they were in jail, so they knew that McGinnis and Cotter had the time card. Quote, "You told the police in the interview on November 16th, did you not, that you and Leon were never together on the day of the robbery?" "I didn't say that. I never said that." "So if the officer testified to that, he wasn't correct? Man, he's a liar." "And if you told the officer in the interview on the 16th that you got home at 7 o'clock on the evening of the robbery and stayed there from thereafter, the officer wouldn't be correct about that too?" "No, he would not be correct. Because you were still out and about. In fact, you were out and about with Leon for a while." Jody interrupts. "I've got a time card to show you." Cotter, "Right? I've got people who, I mean, the lady that just got off the stand was running for mayor of Benton Harbor. Do you think she's going to mess up her good name and her credibility? For me? She doesn't know where you were after 11 o'clock. A little after 11 o'clock. Yeah, but she knew where I was at 7 o'clock. She doesn't know where you were at 11 o'clock, and she doesn't know where you were at 10 o'clock on the night of the robbery. You asked me about 7 o'clock, sir. On the night of the murder, you're saying you were, the restaurant closed at what time? I believe the restaurant closed at, it could have been 7 o'clock, it could have been 10 o'clock, because see, we had just switched schedules for the winter months. So I'm not 100% positive, but I do know that we catered the Boys and Girls Club, that they took lunches out to Bosch that day, and we catered like two other people that day, and I mean, we had, I mean, big pots like this to scrub, and so you had, then we also was exterminating the place late that day. You had to do some cleanup, is that right? And afterwards you were drinking? That's what you said, right? Yes. End quote. Now, Cotter seems to be careful about not asking Jody about McGinnis testifying that Jody said in the interview that they got off work at 10 p.m. and were home by 11. That would have been a dangerous topic to bring up considering LaShawn, Princella, and Cornelius had all just testified that that could not possibly be true. White doesn't mention McGinnis, but he did ask Jody what they told the officers about what they were doing during the murder. Here's Jody's response, quote, "When they asked me where I was at the time that Demario Lowe's got killed, I said I was at home in bed, because I really thought that he got killed that night because when I heard about it, I was home in bed. So I thought he had just got killed. Come to find out, he had got killed 3 or 4 hours before I actually heard about it, you know what I'm saying? So they didn't tell me what time he got killed. So my alibi didn't match, even though the next day they went and checked with Dialos, and Dialos told them I was actually at work when this guy got killed. I didn't know that. I just told the truth of what I thought they said last night. I said I was at home asleep last night." End quote. So what Jody's saying here is that they found out about Mario's murder at like 3 in the morning when Sherelle got home and woke them up. So in Jody's mind, the murder happened sometime in the middle of the night, and they were in bed sleeping when it happened. So when McGinnis asked Jody that day in the interview where they were during the murder, Jody said, in bed sleeping. But then later, the restaurant staff all said Jody was at work at the time of the murder. This was presented by the state as a conflict. Jody saying they were in bed during the murder and the restaurant staff saying that Jody was at work. But it wasn't a conflict. Jody didn't know when the murder had occurred during that interview. Jody continues on explaining that after the work was done, they hung out with Sean and Cornelius having drinks. Quote, "I was there after Princess left. Sean punched me out at 12 o'clock. We sat around at least a good another 45 minutes, and then Cornelius dropped me off at home." End quote. Then during cross, we get a little more detail about the drop-off. Quote, "And just so that I'm correct, what your testimony is that on the night of the murder, Cornelius Simons dropped me off." "Dropped you off?" "Yes, sir." "And then he left?" "Well, he dropped me off. Well, actually, we sat out in front of the house probably about 10, 15 minutes, but then he left." "And was Sherelle there?" "Yes, she was there." "And did you recall ever hearing Sherelle ever mention Cornelius Simons being at your house?" "Well, Sherelle was actually in the house, upstairs in the bedroom. But if she looked out her window, she could see us sitting downstairs outside in Cornelius's green van. But I mean, I don't know what she, I don't, she didn't mention it on the stand, but she knows that. She wasn't asked, so you didn't bring it out, but she knows that, end quote. Jody's night ended up in the apartment with Sherelle. Quote, about the time I got home, had to be about 12:45, somewhere in there, close to 1 o'clock at the most. Did you have a little argument with? Well, when I first came here, see, I had to work from 10 o'clock that morning all the way until, what, 12 o'clock that night? And I had to be at Bob Evans at 10 o'clock the next day. So I'm like, I know I don't really got time to sleep. I'm already wore out. I'm tired, you know what I'm saying? So when, as soon as I came in, I didn't even take a shower or nothing that night. I just took off my clothes. The only thing I had on was a pair of socks, and I just laid across the bed. She yipping and yapping. You can't argue with her. She's always right, you know what I'm saying? There ain't no way to argue with her. So she's on the phone. So I already know what that means. She's going out tonight. You know what I'm saying? She talked to Nadia. End quote. According to Jody, that was the end of their night. Sherelle went out with Nadia and Jody went to sleep. Then around 2:30 a.m. or so, Sherelle came in and told Jody about the murder and that people on the scene were saying that Jody did it. Jody goes back to sleep. Then in the morning, they drove by the crime scene to see what was going on. Jody says they just saw cops and yellow tape up at the scene. And after driving by, Jody says that they drove up to Carvale Miles' house. They say they were planning to ask the Mileses what happened, but there was a bunch of people outside. And according to Jody, they decided not to get mixed up in everything. They gave Carvale a little wave and went on to work. Now, according to Carvale, Jody had driven by and pointed a finger at him and made some kind of a threat. But Jody says that's not what happened. Although, like I said, they do confirm that they drove by and made some kind of gesture to Carvale. But according to Jody, it wasn't a threat. They were just waving, saying what's up. The last part of the testimony that I want to cover is the discussion around Jody supposedly hiding the car. Remember in McGinnis's testimony, he said that Jody refused to tell him where the car was. We've already gone over this part of the transcript in a previous episode where Jody explained that after Sean called them at Bob Evans and told them the police suspected Jody in the murder, Jody left work and went to their mom's house. While up there, Jody and their mom decided to go to the police station to give a voluntary statement. Mom drove, so Jody left their car up at the neighbor's house. And we know from the police reports that Jody's mom not only told the officers where the car was, but she also gave them the keys. Here's where Jody describes the interaction with McGinnis about the car's location. Quote, if that was so innocent, why didn't you just tell the detectives where it was when they asked you? I did. They asked me would I sign a search warrant, and I said, for what? If I'm charged for a robbery of a carjacking, and obviously then you don't need my car. So you told them where your car was? Yes. They didn't have to get a search warrant for it after they found it in Van Buren County. They handed me a search warrant because I refused to sign a search warrant. They didn't ask me for a search warrant for the house. They just went in. Then go in the car. I told them my mother has the keys and my mother gave them the keys. End quote. From the way it sounds, according to Jody, they never tried to hide the location of the car. Jody says they told them where the car was but refused to sign a search warrant. I'm assuming they mean a consent to search. But as far as the location of the car, Jody says that they told McGinnis where it was and told them that their mother had the keys. And nothing from the original reports conflicts with that story at all. A lot of Jody's testimony was damage control, trying to push back against the narrative and the picture of Jody that McGinnis painted on the stand. But for investigative purposes, the most important part of the testimony for us is the alibi testimony. We need to know where Jody was at the time of the murder. You've heard Jody's version of events, and you've heard from witnesses and their memories in 2024 regarding Jody's alibi. But now it's time to hear what their testimony was back in 2002. That's next week on Truth and Justice. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.